Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Daniel Monkman is a musician, songwriter, and film score composer currently based in Toronto, Ontario. Originally from a small town called Selkirk, Manitoba, which is just outside of Winnipeg, Monkman's a member of the esteemed band Ombigize, but first came to prominence for their solo work under the name Zun Gadayowin, an Ojibwe word that they've shortened to Zun. With their 2020 debut album Bleached Waves, Zun broke through in a big way, earning a shortlist nomination for Canada's annual Polaris Music Prize. On April 28, 2023, Paperbag Records issued its remarkable follow-up, Beka Moegan, which prompted Daniel to return to this show to discuss things like Indigenous teachings about climate change and their work on a film project helmed by the producers of the influential ecological TV series The Nature of Things, how the pandemic offered them a respite from touring and a chance to explore different music projects, grieving and mental health, The X-Files as a musical influence, and recent collaborations with Owen Pallett and Sonic Youth's Lee Ronaldo on this new record, the adoption and rejection of the term Two-Spirit in Indigenous culture, and Daniel's recent designation as non-binary, their fascinating use of language in lyrics, future plans for Ombigize and Zun, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. This is a donor-driven podcast, so thank you for all your support there at the Patreon. I hope you'll consider donating to the show at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and very friendly staff at those locations who will happily help you look for whatever it is you're searching for at the stores. Or if you're not anywhere near those two cities and still want to engage with Blackbird, you just go to blackbird.ca and you search for the things you want. Say you want to order both Zune records. Well, the first one might be hard to get, actually. I think it's out of print at the moment. I don't know. Maybe you can get it. But the new one is available. You can get it if you want. Just go in there and type in Becca Mohegan, and you never know. They might be able to ship it right to your house or make sure one's in stock and waiting for you when you go in there. So, again, for more information, visit blackbird.ca. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 776 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Daniel Monkman of Zune, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Daniel. How's it going?
Hi, Vish. It's going great. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to see you and hear you again. Where in the world are you?
Good to see you too. And I'm in Toronto, Ontario. Sunny Toronto, Ontario.
Oh, nice. Yes. I as we're speaking, I heard tell it's like bonkers hot. It's not even warm. It's like, is that true? Is it really, really hot?
I'm in shorts right now.
Shorts.
Yeah, and a t-shirt because it's just like too hot.
Wouldn't it be great if you asked if you watched a newscast and they were doing the weather and the weather person just said, well, I'm wearing shorts. Back to you, Joan. That was it. That's the temper. The weather is I'm wearing shorts. You figure it out. That would be a funnier way of than 32, 27
right.
degrees Celsius. But it is like it's unusually high. Is that correct?
Yeah. And then I was saying that to someone last night. I was like, wow, I can't believe winter's over and I'm just watching Game of Thrones. And then my friend was like, well, it's supposed to ice storm in a day. And I was like, what? Yeah. Ice storm in a day? It's just going to be taken away from us.
That's what I saw. I saw a high of 27 degrees Celsius, which for my international friends who don't know what Celsius means, that's hot. I don't know. I don't even know what the Fahrenheit equivalent is. I never know what the... I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know the conversion either.
But that's hot. That's like a summer day. That's like a nice summer day is like 27 degrees. And then like low of like 11, which is low. That's spring, fall. Then like one day in Ontario, as we're speaking, like in the coming week, it's like zero, like no heat and like an ice storm. So
yeah,
I don't know if you think much about climate change. I know there's discussion sometimes in Indigenous culture about what it means. Do you have any kind of reflection upon this? Like I don't like to use this word lightly, but the insanity of the weather seems... Oh. I don't know. Do you have any insights in this, on this, just given anything you've read about or heard about in your family history or anything like that?
Well, I was just working on a film, like a documentary series, which you probably heard of. It's called The Nature of Things.
Oh, yes, of course. That's amazing. Congratulations. That's great.
Oh, thank you. It was a huge project, and I didn't really understand how huge until I started telling people, and people would be crying. They're like, that was my childhood. I've been working on this film called War for the Woods. I really saw an inside of clear cutting and the effects that it has on the ecosystem, especially in British Columbia, where when I quit music and I was just trying to live, I got a job tree planting. And so I would never fly helicopters, but I remember the first time that I flew in a helicopter to go to an isolation camp to plant trees for I think it was like the oil sands or something. I remember seeing the clear cuts for the first time and just not really processing like, oh, this is like really bad or alarming. But I just remember being like, this was so cool. Hmm. And then watching the film now I'm 31 years old now and watching this, working on this film, like hearing David talk about it, like for 7 months of my life, you start to understand that like, you can't just like clear out old growth or stuff like that is so rich with protecting the ecosystems,
yeah,
without damage actually happening. And
getting out of that film, I have like a new perspective of it too, for sure.
Yeah, it's, you know, I didn't want to start on a down note, but it's right in our faces, all the down stuff. It's just right there. And, you know, usually you talk about the weather and it's pretty banal. Like, oh, yeah, you know, how's it going? Well, it's nice out. It's not nice out. But it's getting to the point where, like, it's erratically, the weather's just changing. So erratic. Yeah, yeah. Does that affect? So that's an interesting point of view that I hadn't really thought of before. And I appreciate your insights there about working on that film. But do you find that this, because people's moods change with the weather. Mm-hmm. If it's a sunny day or if it's not sunny for a spell, people say, well, I'm sad. I'm depressed. I'm not getting my vitamin D and I'm sad. And then if it's really sunny, they get up. What do you think it means if it's all erratic all the time? I mean, like, not just the mood, but like, I would think I'll tell you what I think. I'll just tell you how I feel. You tell me if you can relate. I am terrified. I find that terrifying. If I look at a weather forecast like the one I just described, I get like, whoa, no. I have children. This is upsetting to me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I think about the young people. Like in my culture, we're supposed to think of 7 generations from us. So like when you're preparing the land and you're doing things, you're thinking of like, am I doing something that will be sustainable for 7 generations?
Yeah.
And I think that way of thinking just doesn't operate with corporations and stuff. I think it's like short-term thinking, even though they would like their legacy to live long past them. But I think for them, it's like very short-term getting the profits quickly.
Short-term profiting. So profiteering. Yeah, absolutely. You,
that scares me.
In Zune, I know that you tend to, and in your other projects too, I guess. But you tend to think about your life from like a multi-generational perspective, the history of your family. Within that, if they're involved in such an expression, they can't help but ponder the future as it relates to their heritage and their past and where they are now. Do you feel like there's a lot of pondering of what's coming next for you in your life, in your songwriting? Or I'm trying to unpack this from the records I've heard you make. Congratulations on the new one. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
We've talked at length about my interest in your approach to lyricism, because I don't know if you, I feel like you agreed with me that it's a bit sparse, but direct.
Sometimes.
Anyway, my initial question
most
was.
I
think we talked about it the last time you were on about how I marvel at how catchy your repetition
is.
Like,
I remember that now. Yeah.
Yeah. You say like minimal stuff, but it gets in my head. I think it gets in all our heads. It's just so evocative and it's not like pages and pages of lyrics. It's just like a couple of, anyway, my point is, what was my point? Oh yeah. Temporality, I guess, is my point. Do you find that you do a lot of future pondering on this record or in your work generally? Or is it a lot about unpacking your history, on some level? Like I said, I think they're intertwined, but do you know where I'm coming from here?
Yeah, because I wrote the album in 2020. As soon as like I went on tour, the world shut down and I had a little bit of money, like a few thousand dollars. And when I heard that things were shutting down, I was like, maybe I should invest in a computer so I can do some like home recordings. I don't know, this thing might be a few months or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so I quickly went to Toronto, got a computer, brought it back to my house, and I just immediately started working on this record. And in the beginning of it, like the first couple months or first couple weeks, I was like, okay, this is probably going to end in a month. And then when the month came up, my boss was like, no, we're not going to be doing for at least another month. And I was like, okay, another month. And then it just kept going where my boss finally was just like, don't email us. We'll email you when we're prepared. And I was like, okay. So I finally accepted that this thing might be a really long time. And then I was very alone in my apartment. And that's when I started to just kind of grieve, because I'd lost my dad. And in the grind of trying to get my music heard and working a day job, I just didn't have time to grieve and really grasp the concept of like losing someone in my life who was my father, and very complicated relationship too. And then my friend had passed away in the beginning of the pandemic when they gave CERB he was a recovering addict, and all of a sudden he got this money, and he was just like, got excited, I guess, and did a fentanyl or something. It was mixed in.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry, Daniel.
Yeah, it was really intense in the beginning, and all this stuff was hitting me, and I had nothing but better to do but just kind of like reflect and try to process these two major events in my life, and then experiencing like a collective thing like COVID that we all experienced together. And that's where the title of the record comes from. It's like slowing down, and like for the first time, like I remember when they were talking about that the dolphins were returning to the ocean, yes, or something. It was like, yeah, the clouds are coming, or it was like something was changing, and I felt like this rebirth, and I was like, that's what I was like really focusing and thinking about and hoping for. Like I was like, I hope this is like the changing of the planet.
Yes.
And you know, and then the corporations were like, no, we gotta get back to work. And
we don't need dolphins. We don't.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
don't need clean air in the skies. We gotta get back at it. Yeah. So yeah, within that, you felt rebirth meant new future. And now, how yeah. do you feel about that? Like, when I say new future, every future is new. The next 5 minutes yeah. are going to be new for us. But you know what I mean? Like, we're going to maybe
exactly.
starting from a different kind of ground, like point zero, because of this thing. It's like a reset. So the future will be different than it was if there hadn't been this cataclysmic change. But then, like you said, and I agree with you, sadly, things kind of went back to what some people thought was normal. It's such a weird yeah. word because it's yeah. not normal. Our normal wasn't normal. But anyway, how does that affect your optimism, I guess, for the future, if you will? The fact that it just went reverted back as quickly as possible to kind of bullshittery.
Yeah, I know. It was in, I found a lot of like success during the pandemic, putting out my record.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that. It was like, I got to experience all these good things, but I didn't have to like go out on the road and slug it out there where I was doing that so much leading up to my release. But in that time, I wasn't able to tell people I was signed and I had a record by contract. I couldn't promote my record. So I never got to experience that. And then all of a sudden I experienced it on lockdown. And a lot of my friends were excited to get back on the road. And I was really dreading it. I didn't really want to do it. And when things started to open up, I did get really excited, and I started seeing, like, you could see people, and you're like, hey, how's it going? And, you know, I was really excited for it, but then, obviously, some people didn't have the same experience. Some people had to, like, keep working, yeah. and it was, like, probably really bad for them. Some people couldn't even get that CERB thing, and I can't imagine how desolate their optimism must have been.
You recognize something. Your own privilege, so it's hard not to be...
Yeah.
I get it. It's hard to be doom and gloom when if you're able to function outside of a pandemic. Like, on some level, you're... I will relate to what you're saying. It sounds like you self-consciously flourished during this time that a lot of people didn't. And worse, you know, some of us lost people. You lost people during exactly. this pandemic. Yeah. I lost people because of this pandemic, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So I hear you because I feel the same. And maybe that's also why I'm not eager. I remain not eager to get back to normal. I'm still not doing as much stuff as I used to do. You have, though, like you said, you started to do it. And I know I've seen you've been on the road. When it started to get safer, you said you were dreading it. How's it been since you started playing shows again and touring and whatnot?
Still struggling with it. Like, we just played last night, and last night was good because it was just a hometown show. But when we get on the road, it's like really, really tough for me. I don't even know how to describe it. I think it's what you're describing. It's like going back to normal. I don't think what we were doing, the normal, was healthy.
No.
Like going on the road and just like doing all these things. The way that we're not even like treating artists like actual like workers or anything, like with respect. It's like, it's like the Wild West out there. And it was tough. It was tough to get back because I kept picturing a better future, a better and brighter future for artists. And I kept talking about it. When we were in the pandemic, in the middle of it, I was just like, I can see things changing and getting better for music. Maybe we'll return to a smaller scale, but it will be, it'll be like how in Europe and stuff, people treat artists like it's a trade. And I hate to put it in that kind of terms, but that's just the world we live in. And it'd just be nicer if people could like actually make a living and stuff.
So, okay. So you've kind of hinted at what, I just wonder if people who aren't familiar with what it means to be a touring artist in Europe kind of know what you mean. Because you're talking about the experience. I initially thought you were going to talk about sort of a virus dread or illness dread, but it sounds like you have vocational dread. The notion of going on the road fills you with a certain amount. Like, I'm sure there's excitement in there and you like to play and all that stuff, but it sounds like you actually dread it a little. Oh, God, here come the dates. Yeah. And, I'm putting words in your mouth, but I think that's fair. And you're not the only one I've talked to who's had that. Like, yes, it'll be nice to get back on the road. God damn, I don't really want to go back on the road. As you may guess, when I talk to artists who are more my age or in my situation with a family, one of my friends is someone who his band would traditionally be on the road 290 days of the year, probably. You know what I'm saying? And and they have a child. And so during the pandemic, it was such a relief for their partner and for them to be home. And then as soon as things started to kick back, the absence was really felt. You know, when he hit the road again, the absence at home was felt. So it is a catch-22, because that's how they make a living. That's how that work sustains the family finances and whatnot. It has to be done. Anyway, I've gone on a bit of a rant there. Wow. I forget what my original question was. Oh, can you home in on what it is that, what's the best way of putting this in a less melancholy way? What is the, what you hinted at it, what you would hope to see happen for artists in North America versus Europe. Can you dial into that a little bit more? Like, what is the treatment like in Europe compared to here? When you say you were hoping for a better future for musicians and for artists, like, let's get into it. Nuts and bolts. You're on the road. You're getting to venues. Mm-hmm. You're playing shows. What would you like to see in Canada or in America that would actually benefit you mentally, spiritually, you know, in terms of your physical health? Well, can you articulate that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a lot of just little things that artists could use that would help them for the longevity of sustaining a life that is on the road a lot. And, you know, there's things like, say, like a solo artist takes a band on the road and paying every individual person $200 to $300 each. And then accommodations and food and all that stuff. It's like in Europe, a lot of places they feed you, they sleep, they put accommodations for you, and all those little things help so much. And here in the States, Canada's a little bit better because it's a little bit looser and stuff, a little grassroots. But America, it's just like the Wild West, and I hear that's like the UK too. But it's mostly just little things like that, and just, but also like just valuing music and how actually important it is to the culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's such like an important thing, and it's, I don't want to get too cheesy, but it is like a universal language. Like if I didn't speak a certain language, but I was sitting in her room with someone and we heard a beautiful piece of piano or something, I'm sure we could both appreciate it, right? You know, and it's like that to me is really special, and that's why I do music. It's to connect.
Yeah.
And I felt like there was a disconnect happening with the artists and the environment that the artist is in. It's always like, oh, the moody artist, like that. It's like, well, why is the artist moody? Why is the artist doesn't want to talk to anyone after a show? Is it because it's like a very soul-sucking experience for most people? Some people eat it up, and that's, and you see them, that's the famous people, you know, and but they struggle too.
I think the adventure of being on tour has lost its luster, because in my day, when you would go on tour, it was kind of like camping. You kind of didn't know where you'd be sleeping and necessarily, and you'd figure it out when you get to town. I will say, for some reason, I was rather proficient as a road manager in getting us places to stay. And everybody, I don't know how, I don't know why. I was always the one who could do it. And then, you know, at people's places, if we could avoid paying for hotels, motels. And, but I feel like that you're not the only one who's been outspoken about this from the perspective of the artist in the last few years. I'm sure you're aware of this. Lots of people have, some people have said, I'm done. I'm not even doing this anymore. It's so, like you mentioned, fuel and accommodations and food, everything's so expensive. So where I'm coming from is two things here. One, the harder question is, have you had these thoughts of like, I don't think I want to be a road dog anymore at all. It's not fun. It's not healthy. It's not affordable. Have you had that thought? And secondly, because of all this outspokenness, and I don't know if you agree with me on that, but I feel like a lot more artists are talking about their mental health and the physical and financial toll of touring. Do you think they're being heard? Do you think you're being heard right now by the people that put together events and shows? Like, is it resonating? Have you seen any evidence of that? So two things. Would you want to stop? If you could stop, would you stop? Have you had that thought? And secondly, do you think in being more outspoken, it's actually causing things to improve even incrementally at the moment?
Yeah, like I in my group of friends of musicians, they all know me as someone who doesn't enjoy touring. And if I could have, the reason why I'm doing more film scores is so that I have the freedom to make a choice if I need to go on the road. Where before it was like, I gotta sell these records because I wanna get onto a bigger bracket with Factor. So with Factor, I could get more grants, and then with more grants, I could subsidize and then blah, 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 and I could keep some of my profits. And then in return, slowly I could build something. And when you're just left with that option of only touring, that can be really tough.
Yeah.
That can really be really tough. But I knew that as a creative mind, there's multiple ways to make money. And when I got really into film scoring, I saw the freedom that it could bring to me.
Yeah.
And I do it all from my home. I don't have to go on the road.
Right.
I went to Mexico and I worked on the film there, but like it gives me a lot of freedom and I like that. And so right now I'm in a really comfortable spot of not feeling too much pressure of going on the road, you know, but I still get it. I still have that feeling of like, oh no, like I should go on the road because if I don't, then I won't get the exposure and maybe get a Juno nomination or something, you know, because that stuff really matters to them. They want to see that the artist is out there really slaving, and that's the system that we're in. It's like this backward system of all like the Junos, the Factors, like you feel all of them want...
External pressure. Yeah. You feel external pressure from some of these organizations in a way. Yeah.
To qualify for some of them, you have to be doing so much work, and I don't think they put into account inflation and mental health and the state of the music industry.
Well, listen, I appreciate you speaking on these things. I hope you're never afraid to. Some people wouldn't. And it's not,
I know.
It's not always the most fun subject matter, but I appreciate it because it's the reality of what my guests on this show and my friends are going through, if I may. So I just want to say it's appreciated, and I hope you find peace with it one way or the other. It sounds like you're getting there, figuring out other ways to make a living. The other side of it is, particularly in a post-Napster streaming age, it was like touring's the only way to make money, and that's not true now because of how expensive it is. So then there's a real reckoning, and all of it comes back to what you were saying earlier about how devalued art and music is. And again, not fun or pleasant fodder for conversation, but I just want to say it's important to talk about it as far as I'm concerned. So thank you.
I think so too. Yeah, I appreciate when artists were starting to become very real with how the operation actually goes, because the facade and the illusion online, you can paint any canvas and make it seem like you're somewhere else. And
well, that's the other weird part of this, right? Because social media, which artists are more involved in, is a fake thing. It is a fake reflection. Usually like, look how cool this is. Look how fun this is. But it's not real. Like, I mean, it's that one moment in a day, maybe, that was okay. And then the rest of your time, you're like, shit,
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's some
reality.
Yeah, there's some fakery in all this. I want to get to this brilliant new record of yours, because you alluded to a couple of things have gone on with you since we last spoke. I would say you made a couple of records that were critically acclaimed, both on your own and with our mutual colleague, Adam Sturgeon. And congratulations on that. Then you start talking about the film score work you're doing. I wonder how those various experiences informed your approach to making this brand new record. Because I would think that, I know from personal experience talking to friends who have entered the realm of film scoring, or like just stepped a little bit outside of the realm that they're used to working in as a songwriter and a singer. Some of my friends, you say film scoring. Some of my friends score video games. Totally different experience from what they're kind of known for. And it, and then it ends up kind of bleeding into their whole expression. Like their film and video game scores start to get a little more whatever their core sensibility is. And then that other assignment stuff starts to inform their actual expression. Has there been a bit of a swirl for you as you've done other projects? Has it informed what Zune is at the moment?
Before the pandemic, I had worked on a few films, and but going way far back, I remember when I would go visit my dad in the late 90s in Winnipeg, I would go visit him and he would show me how to use the VHS player and the VHS rewinder, like super rewinder.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, you pop it in, you press rewind, Danny, and in a few seconds it'll be at the start. And so I'd watch movies, really inspiring movies that I didn't know at the time as a kid, like musically. But I remember watching the first X-Files movie, and the person who scored it was this guy named Mark Snow.
Hmm.
And he's really, really good. And I didn't know it as a kid, but I just remembered getting drawn to these string arrangements and very cinematic moments. And that always stuck with me throughout my life. And I was always drawn to like a orchestral music. Like when I heard Nick Drake, I was like, oh my gosh, I love the strings. Or, and so I was just always drawn to that type of music, and that I always wanted to make a record that was like that, that sounded like that.
Hmm.
And when I was doing film scores, it was more ambient music and stuff like that, and very like beautiful, but no strings yet, and no big like cinematic orchestral stuff. But getting into making this record, I had finally like had support from the label, because with the, my debut, they didn't know what it was going to be.
Yeah,
they actually like cut half of the funding, the promotional funding, because they were like, oh, this is just some niche thing. We actually, this too risky. And then when it got some acclaim, they were like, okay, your next record, like we have some more support. We can like help you with other things.
And right.
I found myself in a position where I could like make a record like that. And I was making film at the same time. So it was just like bleeding really into, there was moments from the record that were supposed to be in a film score, but I just like kept it because I was like, oh, this is like too weird and it doesn't really go with the film. But yeah, like the film scoring really bled into Zune and is bleeding into Om Big Azay as well.
Is it? Okay. That's interesting. Okay. And I mean, you talk about strings. I feel like when you were on the show to talk about, I think it was during the Zune chat, you referenced Owen Pallett, working with him to try to figure out some string arrangements. And here they are. They sound wonderful. What was it like working with Owen to bring these string parts to life?
Oh, yeah. I can't believe it. That was when all that time ago that I was talking about bringing, working with Owen Pallett.
Yeah, it was like a few years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, that was so long ago. Holy moly. Yeah. It was just exactly what I thought it was going to be, you know, just Owen kind of like mad genius. You know, it was really hard to track him down, though. It took about a year to really track down Owen to like...
He's a busy guy.
Yeah, like really busy at that time, too. I was like, he was just working on the new Arcade Fire record, if you can believe that. And
I can believe that. And he's basically a member of that band. That makes sense.
Yeah. So it was like
that's his job in that band, I would say. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard to track him down and get him to work on that. But after once I got him locked in, we were working with this orchestra called the Flame Orchestra. And I think they're called the O Flame Orchestra. And yes, working with Owen, I was just so amazed with what Owen did. Because Owen created everything MIDI first. And even on like really weird shoegazy songs, I was like, I don't even know what Owen will do for this. And then he just showed me all these like cello parts that just like work so well. And I unconsciously didn't play much bass on the record, like almost next to none, because I didn't own one. So it allowed Owen to work so well with the record, and I didn't even understand that at the time. But once Owen was just like, oh, it was incredible, there's no bass, so it's just like I could move around so much, and it ended up just working just by chance. And there's really beautiful moments in the record that really show the beauty of the orchestra.
I can't recall. Can you write or read music per se?
No, I can't.
So when you're talking to someone like Owen, who, for those who don't know, Owen Pallett, goddamn genius. Just like a musical, I don't know if he's a prodigy, or he was. I don't know how that works anymore when you're a man, an adult. But he can do anything with music. Let's put it that way. So is it a case where you're like, yeah, so I had this melody in mind. Bop, bop, beep, dabba, doop, bop, bee. Can you turn that into strings? And then he goes, yeah, all right, I'll figure that out. Is that how it worked? Like, would you sound phonetically? Like, how do you describe what you're going to do? I guess you're both in Toronto, right?
Yeah, Toronto. So
would you get together to talk about this?
Well, it was during the pandemic, so was like very like remote.
I see.
But we met up and Owen would show me parts. We sat in his apartment and we worked on things. But he would mostly like either come up with his own parts, his own melodies, or he would hear something that I was doing in the song and then mimic it and like kind of reinforce it. And and then in the mixing, we would take out my original thing and just leave an Owen's. And then just be like... It was kind of like that, you know?
Okay.
But I know people like Beck, he would like hum to his dad who works the orchestra, most of the string arrangements on his records.
Yeah.
He would hum it and then his dad would just like come up with parts. And it will probably work like that, you know? Because that's a lot of time I'll just come with a song and like just little humming parts.
I think that's what McCartney used to do with George Martin as well. Like just be like, here's what I want to... Because he can't read or write music either, Paul McCartney.
Oh,
Paul, by the way, people, Paul McCartney was in a band called Wings. If you don't know Wings, check them out. Fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, so he would do the same thing, I think. So it's not unusual to do that. So that's fascinating. That's really interesting. You also, among the guests, there are a few different guests here, but one of them, another one that caught my eye on this new record is someone I've become friendly with over the last couple of decades myself, Lee Ronaldo of Sonic Youth. Sounds like that was a bit happenstance in terms of getting to know Lee. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that it was going to actually happen at all. It was very by like... It was a series of events dating back to 2018 that led me to that recording session that I had met Lee, and then we just found out that we like just knew a lot of the same people. And but I was in 2018 I got a show offer with a band called the Medicine Singers and Yonatan Gat at Lee's Palace in Toronto, and I took the gig, met them, they fell in love with me, I fell in love with all the Medicine Singers and Yonatan Gat and his guitar playing. And And we just kept in touch throughout the year. We'd send each other music and blah, blah, blah. And when the world was shut down, they were working on a record and I was always sending them stuff and we were going to do something. And when the world opened back up and they started touring and playing music, Yonatan Gat was just always like, Danny, we would love to have you play with us. It would be so cool to have a younger Indigenous person in the band with us, you know, at any level you want, at least come record with us. And so last FME festival, like last summer, Yonatan was like, come play with us FME and then come record with us at Hotel Tatango. He's like, Lee Ronaldo will be there, people from Godspeed and a few other folks. And I was like, dude, of course I'll come record.
Of course, yeah.
So that week was really intense for me. My manager at the time kind of screwed up my schedule and almost canceled that rehearsal. It was like, you can't make it. You're supposed to be somewhere else. Uh-huh. And I was really got in a crossroads with them. And I was like, no, like, this is really important. This needs to happen. And it can't be any other way. Whatever you got to do, you have to figure it out, change things. But that date can't change.
Right. Of course.
And literally it couldn't. It couldn't. I was like, I don't know what you got to do.
Yeah.
You got to figure it out.
Yeah.
And blessed that the person at the time figured it out and it worked out. And I was able to go out there and record. But that's where I met Lee, and he like rode in on a Uber, got out of an Uber, and maybe I shouldn't say this stuff, but then we just had a good time, and I just didn't expect to see him and him do this, the thing that he did, and I was just like, oh my God, this is exactly what I wanted, how I would want to meet someone like this, and yeah, and obviously Lee's like indie rock celebrity that I really just wanted to treat him like a musician in the studio. And so when we were writing in the studio, I'd always just be like, what do you think about this, Lee? Like, what do you think about this? Or we'd be singing and stuff like that. And just not asking him questions. Even when we were outside having a break, I would just be like, asking him what projects he had on the go or how his family was doing and stuff like that. Yeah. And then slowly asking questions. He started asking me questions. He's like, where are you from? And I was like, Winnipeg. That's where I was born.
Oh, wow. That's a connection for him. Amazing.
And then right away, he's like, Winnipeg? He's like, that's where my wife, Leah, is from. Yeah. We go there every year. I was like, what, really? I was like, yeah. I was like, I grew up in the North End. He's like, the North End? He's like, that's where I recorded my solo album about the North End women.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, that's where I lived. I lived on Salter and stuff like that. And then it just like kept going into this thing where we knew all the same people. And then he was like, wait a minute. He's like, so what music do you make? I was like, well, I just made this record called Bleached Waves. And it was like nominated for this award called Polaris. And he's like, what kind of music is it? I was like, well, people were calling it moccasin gaze, but it's like indigenous mixed with like powwow drumming and wall of sound. Mm-hmm. But it kind of goes everywhere. And he had this like thing on his phone, and he was like, scan it and take my information, let's keep in touch. He's like, I want to hear about this moccasin gaze. And I was like, I can't believe Lee Ronaldo's saying this in my mind, but I was like, yeah, Lee, I'll definitely give you a copy. Yeah. I was like, if I can find one, but they're sold out and it's like kind of hard to find right now. Like my label won't print anymore for a while. And so we exchanged numbers, and we were staying at the agents who were hosting the event, like the recording session, put us at the same hotel. So we were always talking, and my partner, who I used to date, is this painter in New York, and she signed to this art gallery who I was talking to Lee about, and he was like, those are my friends. I was like, all these connections. It was so strange. So we got our separate, we record that album with the Medicine Singers, and it was like such a good experience. And we record the album and we go our own ways. And then Lee like texts me, I think Lee texted me being like, hey, Daniel, just wanted to say hi. And here's the photos from the weekend. I just want to say that my son Sage says hi and says that he played your record Bleached Waves in 2020 on his radio station CIUT in Toronto.
Yeah, his son had a show on the University of Toronto radio station. That's right. Yeah, Lee would often talk about that. That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just like, holy shit. Hey, Sage, you know, and then I was like, my record was still trying. I was trying to finish my record, and then I went to New York to record and listen to what we had made months before, and Lee was playing with Yola Tango. Mm-hmm. And invited us down there, and in that time of talking about his son Sage, I shared with Lee that I was working on a new record, or he asked me,
yeah,
I can't remember,
yeah,
but I was like, do you want to play on it at all? He's like, yeah, send me over, whatever. I was like, literally the label needs it in 2 hours. Like, this is no joke. I still have the text messages of like being like, actually my label wants in 2 hours. Like, do you think you could do anything? And he was like, I think I could do something. I was like, he's like, just depends on what the song is. And I was like, I'll give you the easiest song to play on.
Yeah.
And so I just gave him like a really easy ambient song. And I was like, just do whatever. Mm-hmm. And the label was like, we'll give Lee Ronaldo all the time that he needs to record the part. So I was like, you got a day. And then he came back super quick and I wanted him to play more and he wanted to play more. And he's like, too bad we couldn't do more. But when at the YOLO Tango show, he's like, my schedule's opening up and like, let's do something soon or something. And I was like, okay, I'll get music together. And so that's kind of what I've been doing the last little while.
Lee and I, like I say, have become friendly over the last couple of decades. He's wonderful and very social. Right. I think that's what I have learned about Lee. Like your story doesn't seem uncommon to me. Lee and I have so many mutual friends and he's very outgoing and open to hearing from people and collaborating with people. So it's lovely. I just want to say this is a lovely story. It kind of corroborates feelings and thoughts I've had about Lee. Wow. And it's so nice that he sees something in you because we see it too. And I'm just saying, it's very nice. It's very nice. Wow. Now, the song you mentioned there that Lee contributes to, I think is a significant one for you in your life trajectory. Can you expand upon that particular song and what it means to you at this point? By the way, as far as I can recall, and forgive me if I'm wrong, I believe it's an instrumental. However, it has a title that connotes something. I'm really building this up. Daniel, can you talk a little bit about what that song is called, what that means, and what it means to you? Is that possible?
Yeah, of course. So for a big portion of my life, I lived in really kind of sketchy situations with like a lot of homophobic, I would say like people who were involved in gangs.
Yes.
And selling drugs and stuff like that. And as a child, I remember always feeling, I was raised by my mom, my aunties, my grandma. I had some communication with my dad, but he was unable to really be there. So I was really raised and protected by feminized people my entire life. And I don't really have much uncles. Like we had one, but he was never around. So it was just like really matriarchal upbringing for me. Like that's what I was really raised on. I was really raised early on about like my mom, whenever she had like her period and stuff like that. I remember at a young age question being like, why is it there blood in the toilet?
Yeah, yeah.
And my mom always just like, any time in my life, I was always protected by my aunties and my mom. So I was always drawn to feminine energy and always felt safer around queer folk and just like feminized people. But just, it doesn't even have to be a feminized person. Just that it wasn't even like feminized. It was just this type of energy that was something that I was very familiar with and felt safe and secure with. And I just didn't feel that way when I was on the streets hanging out with these types of folks. And I felt like I could never like express myself, but I was always called out on certain things. People would always like kind of make fun of how sensitive I was. And going to rehab and learning more about myself and accepting myself brought me closer to who I wanted to be and actually express myself. And I remember putting out bleached waves and feeling like a lot of body dysmorphia. And I was struggling with the skin stuff on my face. It was like eczema or something. It was really intense. And I just didn't feel safe enough. But with this record, I just remember wanting to show that support and really just as my own experience of self-love is just like honoring yourself, you know?
Sure.
And that's what I felt like I was doing with this record, was just like honoring it. I didn't want it to be like this major thing in my life where like this is going to be my whole identity. It's just that this was just a little acknowledgement to myself and just for other people to understand who I am. They want to get to know me better. But it's never like I get upset if someone doesn't see it the same way as I do. It's more just for myself. And that's what that song was about. It's the reason why it was instrumental. For one thing, because I was working on a lot of films, but what I love about instrumental music is that no one's spoon feeding you a narrative when you're listening to it. You're just kind of like hearing sounds, and you're kind of left in your own subconscious to think for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted. And the reason why I just named it the title is because that's just when I listen to that, that's how I think. That's what I was thinking about at the time.
I hinted at this, but what is the title and what does it mean?
It's kind of like a long name, and in my culture there's not really a word to, how do I describe this? Like, it's two-spirit, but where I come from, it's not, we don't really call it two-spirit, but because the way the world is right now, most people know two spirits. So that's kind of, it was just like more of a placeholder for people to understand what I meant. But it's called Nish Manaduig.
Nish Manaduig. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but Niji, some people just call it Niji or something. And that's just kind of short for it. But that's one way to describe it. For me, it's something else, but I still haven't figured it out. But
you know, I will say, I don't mean to interject, but I have heard. So what happens, certainly among white people, is they glom onto a term. It's hard to keep. I just want to give everyone here the benefit of the doubt. It can be difficult, I will say, to keep up with all the terminology. How you're supposed to talk about things, how you're supposed to describe people. And in the last 10 years, I think, I would argue, and as someone who kind of pays attention to lexicon stuff, two-spirit started to emerge as a way of categorizing people and their orientations and all those sorts of things. And then what I heard is like within a few years, actually, from like indigenous scholars, we don't actually use that term.
Yeah,
that's a term other people use. And I think when they say other people, they mean academics or well-meaning, but maybe well-meaning. I don't know. People who are just trying to be allies, but then the terms change and then the allyship feels like, oh shit, I'm saying the wrong thing. I thought we were all saying this. So it gets a little confusing. I just want to put that out there. I'm not making excuses for anyone. No. But it is, would you admit, Daniel, it can be a bit complicated to keep up?
Yeah, of course. And that's why it was like hard to even start this conversation, but I knew that I just wanted to. And when people want to ask me, I can go in depth, like what I'm doing right now. And then it gives me a chance to actually explain to people. Cause some people like, that I know that that's maybe not a term that we would use, but it's just like,
it's in the lexicon. It's like what people understand. Like people, I think, sorry, can you do this for me, Daniel? Like for someone who doesn't know what two-spirit means at all, has not heard the term, do you have a definition for it? Like, I know you're going to come at it from a personal perspective, but you and I are both kind of dancing around the fact that people are employing this term, but may not, again, it may not actually be the correct term from people who would know, but it is still the one that people are using. I see it in all sorts of documents about proper terms to use. How do you define it for yourself? Or sorry, can you do me a favor and everyone listening? Can you give people the layman's definition of what people think it is and what it means? And also briefly talk about what it means from your perspective personally. Can you do both of those things?
Yeah. So I think the two-spirit, the general thing is someone who draws from the masculine and feminine energy and somehow it is molded as one. And for me, I think it's just like maybe a little bit more complicated because I don't see it as like just like two different things. I think of it as like, how would you describe it? Like, it's like a spectrum almost, like, and it's not even like you're two things at once. It's like,
The common terminology these days is non-binary. Is that the closest?
I think so. Something like that. Yeah, like non-binary. But it's like, I don't even get upset when people call me hear anything. It's like not even like I don't see this like that still. It's like I just know that I feel comfortable around feminine energy, and that's where a lot of my intuition comes from, because I was just so raised with my mom, and I can pick up on certain things, but I never want to categorize it as just like this is a feminine thing. And because like I know hyper feminine people who have masculine characteristics too.
Yeah.
You know, it's just funny how we're in a world where it's, there's a lot of definitions for things, and it's people kind of get lost in the translation or something.
Well, but some of it emanates from a very personal feeling and sensation that that's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And where it gets complicated is in your case as a public figure, there has to be some semblance of presentation of who you are.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you have probably always thought that you are whatever it means to be two spirit, but it hasn't really, to my knowledge, this is a relatively new definition for yourself, right? It's part of the album promotion, is like, this is a revelation you made about yourself in recent times.
Public,
is that right?
Yeah.
Where
I released it public. It was, a sibling who encouraged me to be like, maybe you should like actually like tell people. Start telling people now, because it's been a while, and you want to like show support. It was definitely during the Black Lives Matter where my sibling was like, you should really like,
you felt empowered.
Express it, because I'm an influencer or something that.
You have a platform, yeah.
Yeah, where my siblings and I come from, there's no one who has maybe done stuff like I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I'm saying what I'm doing is super important, but for Indigenous youth and not having role models, you know, not paintings or pictures or posters of Native people, a lot of them have posters of Brad Pitt or something.
Yeah,
you know, and that's their role model. And it's important that our youth have real models, you know, not just a role model, like real people. So even though I was identifying in this certain way for some time, there became a point where I was like, you know what, Randy, that does make a lot of sense. That having a platform like me now, I shouldn't take it for granted, and that it is important to have community and to support each other in that way.
You have a song here that is expressing something deeply personal for yourself, and it's an instrumental. I alluded earlier to my admiration for what you are able to do with relatively sparse lyrics, meaning what you're able to, the emotion and the meaning you're able to convey with relatively minimal language use. One other thing that popped for me on this record, and it's not new to your aesthetic, and I don't know if you would agree with me, but it feels to me like the lyrics, or rather the vocals, are low in the mix. I think in your expression and in the trajectory of whatever shoegaze or ambient music is, the vocal, someone can be a fantastic singer, and in some musical realms, that vocal would be high in the mix. But I think in your expression, the vocal is a texture. It's as much of a texture as the other sounds that are manipulated and processed. So I understand that part. Do you feel like the vocals are even lower than usual for you? Are really, really a texture as much as they are? Because I read the lyrics off the page and I'm like, holy shit. But then when I listen, I don't hear the articulation as much. It's a feeling. Does that resonate with you? I don't mean to be insulting, but does that resonate with you?
No. What song do you think that is? Do you know?
I feel like it's true of... It's a good point you raised, because some are brighter than others, higher in the mix than others.
Because there's a few songs that I recorded and wrote, and I was like, this is perfect. This is exactly it. And then there was a couple tracks where we recorded the vocals... We improvised.
Oh, okay.
My friend Andrew McLeod, a sunsetter. They sang on a language disappears and Gagaji.
Yeah.
And both of those, I was just like, Andrew, what are you even saying or singing about? And he never had an explanation.
I see. That's not even necessarily you then. Okay.
No, it isn't. And I do backup singing and do the higher parts, but I was just like, dude, what are you even saying? So I'm singing some different than him, but it's just the same melody.
Mm.
And it's really hard because now I'm learning the song and I'm like, what are we even singing?
Okay.
But yeah. For me, the title of a song is just almost just as important and meaningful.
Yeah.
So when I named it A Language Disappears, I was like, that's what it, the song is about to me. But the lyrics, I don't even know.
Well, I mean, then the lyrics reflect the title because you don't really know what's being said.
Wow. I never thought about that. That's what I'm going to start telling people now.
I know that it's probably not your intention when you talk about the erasure, the cultural erasure that you and your people have experienced. But it probably works in that context to have kind of two different lyrical expressions happening at once and not really cohering in a sense. Like,
that's interesting. Wow. A language disappears and it's like you don't even know what language it is being spoken or sung. Wow.
Well, I'm glad we had this chat. I think I've illuminated your own record for you. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
All this to say,
that's so true.
It's a really beautiful album, and it's hitting me in, no pun intended, in terms of your last record. It hits me in waves. Like, I get meaning from it each time I listen to it. It's one of those things where I think you have to dig deep. And like I say, I'm in the fortunate position to have lyrics sent to me, so that gives me a whole other perspective. We've talked about some specific things, but to wrap up, is there an overarching thing you'd want to say about where you felt you were coming from in terms of the lyrics you composed for this record? Do you sense now, as it's getting ready to be released, that you were on a particular trip when you wrote this batch of songs?
I think some of these songs were taken from about 10 years ago, and some of them brand new, and then some of them somewhat new, and they were all drawing from different times in my life. But when I listened to them together, I felt like, because they were still just coming from me, the same but different version of me, it all made sense. And I just liked that idea of writing an album, because even though I did write them, some of them, a while ago, reworking on them with the mindset that I have now was just like really interesting way to write this album, because like when I was 18, I'm totally different than I am now, but somehow it still made sense.
Yeah.
And I just hope that music always will be like that for me. I get scared when things in music don't work out because I'm just so lucky or something. I don't know. That I'm like hyper successful or anything. I just mean like, I feel like I've just always lucked out with writing a song. I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And I'm like, that song I wrote years ago, somehow it made sense on this record. Great. Something about that music that I just really love that I hope never ends.
I appreciate that. And when you say luck, I mean, in our previous conversations, you have conveyed a certain humility and like stuff just kind of happens. Someone plays your song on the radio and you're like, what? Like, I remember you telling me that story, that someone played your song on like the college radio station and you couldn't believe it. And that's a huge thing to have something you put out there, be recognized and have it resonate enough with someone that they decide to put it on the airwaves. So, and here we are now, like, you know, you've got someone from Sonic Youth on your record. You've got Owen Pallett working with you. Like, it's not all luck. I'll tell you that. You're onto something here. So I appreciate that. Daniel, what's coming up next for you and for Zune and your other projects? Is there anything that you can share with us about forthcoming releases or new songs you're working on? Any other projects that you want to, or touring? Anything you want to share right now?
What do I got on the go? I got to finish a lot of projects just now, but I'm just about to start recording like my next record.
Oh, there you go.
Because, you know, like this newest one was recorded in 2020 and it was basically done by 2021. It was just a matter of waiting for Owen Pallett and then Mark Lawson to mix it. And that took majority of the time, 80%, like I would say 60% of the time was waiting for those folks. So in that time, I had a lot of spare time to write and record. And I've just accumulated a lot of songs. And now I'm getting ready to just kind of like find the best ones and send them to Lee and my friend Joe Pass. And maybe do a record with them and just see what I can do.
That's awesome. That's great. I'm just happy to hear that you're already on to the next thing.
Yeah, always. You know, you just... this is like what we were going back to talking about in the beginning. It's like once you're in the cycle, it's like it's hard to like see out of it. You know, I was listening to an interview with Beck, and he's like, God forbid I take 3 years off and everybody forgets who I am.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh God, right? Like, isn't that true? Like, especially nowadays we talk about fast fashion, but now it's like fast consciousness or something where just everything is sped up. So it's just like, yeah. Trends are in and out, and it's just like, if you're not in it, you lose it or something. That's the fear that capitalism puts in you. But
yeah,
I hope that that's not true.
That's weird. I deleted it, but I had a tweet going where, like, I don't understand. You make one podcast and then you just have to make another one right away. It's just a never ending, like a cycle. Like every week I got to do this. It's kind of like, anyway, I delete it because I'm like, I sound like I'm whining about a thing that I made. Like I made, it's weird, right? We have these compulsions and we create the cycles we're on. And sometimes you're not aware of that. Like, oh, I can actually stop this. When you're like, well, you're pulling your hair out and you're like, but I invented this and I got to go through this sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. It begins with you and it ends with you.
Yeah.
You know,
but it feels external. Like I feel like, well, my listeners are expecting it. The community of artists I support are expecting it, but it does every once in a while. I'm like, I just need a break and I don't give myself one. It's weird.
No, I know. And I really failed myself with that. Not taking a break, and my health got like really, really bad, and I'm just recovering.
Oh man.
Like I'm just now doing interviews and stuff because my eyeballs were swollen and there was like pus coming out of them because I got this infection.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was bad. Oh, and boy. And my doctor says that something like that only happens when your immune system is so low.
Yeah.
And
stress related too.
Yeah, stress related. And I was at the Junos and that was like so crazy. And my immune system is just so shot that
I didn't mean to laugh.
Fell apart.
Yeah.
No. Give it to the Junos to catch some kind of virus that just like attacks my eyeballs.
Everyone who went to the Junos got back and was like, I don't feel so good. And I was like, well, I'm glad I didn't go. It was in my hometown here in Edmonton. And I was like, nah.
That's right.
I only went to like, I had to do a couple of things for work. But anyway, that's a digression. I hope you're doing better. It sounds like you are. And I appreciate this time, Daniel. If people want to learn more about Zune and follow your exploits using their telephones and computers, where would you like to sort of send them online?
I would say follow me on Instagram. That's at Zune Gadayawan. And Om Bigizai is the other project. So that's OMBIIGIZI.
Yeah.
And yeah, just look up those two names and get all the music that we're putting out.
I'll link to those things in the write-up for this pod as well, so people can click on those things and follow Daniel and all his work. Daniel, if we can go out on a song from this new record, I wonder if you can pick one for us and tell us why you chose it.
Okay, I would say I'll go with Dotem.
Dotem. Now, why did that come to mind?
Dotem because... it was a song that I wrote on the reservation about maybe like 8 years ago when I was really going through a lot and my dad and I had reconnected and I was writing this song. I was listening to a lot of singer-songwriter stuff like Gordon Lightfoot or something like that with my uncle. Hmm. And I really wanted to just like make this singer-songwriter song style song. And I wrote that one day and my Uncle Matt was like, Danny, That's a good song.
You gotta, that's
you
nice.
You gotta keep that for yourself. Yeah, he's like, you gotta keep that for yourself. Because I went through this phase where I was writing songs for people. Not that anyone wanted any of them, but I was just like, I want to be a songwriter. And but that was the one that he told me to keep for myself. And
I see.
And so so then I immediately gave it to someone after that. And then got the rights back for it maybe like 3 years ago or something like that. My manager did some digging and he found out that the contract that I was working wasn't actually like good or something. So we just spoke to the band and they were like, yeah, you can have it. So we got the rights back. And then I was like, I'm re-recording it. And then I did.
Now this is an elemental song. There are references to the ocean. You also do a thing that I'm a fan of, and I alluded to earlier, where you kind of pick a phrase and repeat it, but vary it. So when people listen to this, you'll hear, even if I wasn't in sight, even if I wasn't wrong, even if I couldn't write, even if I wasn't true, even if I came through for you. So you've kind of settled on something there to get the narrative going, but you vary it. I'm on to you, Daniel. You have these really cool, these nice, cool tricks that I like, and I notice them all the time. So I just appreciate that you know your core, and you still, it's, I'm just saying, I hope that doesn't come across the wrong way. I think it's,
I
think it's fascinating that you're able to do so much. Again, I think I may have said this to you before. It reminds me kind of like of Iggy Pop in The Stooges, where he would just say a couple of things and it's in your head for the rest of your life. Like the same words just over and over again. And you're just like, yeah, that's a great song. That's not, it doesn't have to always be Gordon Lightfoot and Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, where it's just like a billion things. No offense to Gordon, but you know what I'm saying? So I just want to commend you on that. And without further ado, let's play this new song, Dotem by Zune. Daniel, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I hope you enjoyed this I hope we speak again sometime, and best of luck in the future.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Oh, thank you once again, Daniel Monkman of Zune, for appearing on this, the 776th episode of Creative Control, which, for those of you who don't know, is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available just about wherever it is you get your podcasts. If you can't locate an episode that you're looking for, you've heard about it, somebody's told you about one, and it's from a long time ago or something, and you can't find it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook, the cockroach of social media platforms. Or you can follow the show on Twitter. I don't know if it's the cockroach. At Vish Creative. Or you can follow me directly on Twitter and Instagram at vishkana. Also, this is a donor-driven podcast, ostensibly, and I'm fine with that. Although, sometimes I feel like, I don't even know what those sounds mean. I'll just carry on with my spiel. This is a donor-driven podcast, and if you feel compelled to contribute to the show's work with your financial contributions, you can at patreon.com/creativecontrol. That's where you can make a flexible monthly donation to support me and this show. $6 USD, American, or more, grants you access to exclusive content. You get the episodes earlier than everybody else. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt at that $6 or more level, you can do all that. Just got to message me on Patreon. By the way, if you can't do $6, people do all sorts of things. They do less than $6, whatever amount they want. They do a lot more, some of them, which is very kind. I appreciate it all. Whatever you can do, just head over to patreon.com/creativecontrol and make a decision yourself. Thank you so much for your support. Speaking of support, thanks again to the wonderful Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which has physical locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta. And you can learn more about those. And you can also order things from their website at blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. If you want to learn more about any of those places, check out the show notes. There's some links, and you can click on things and figure that stuff out. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music of his for the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. Always up to something, that Jim. Plotting, scheming, making music for everyone. It's nice. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Daniel. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. And if you're unfamiliar with Zune, I hope you will check them out. And if you are very familiar with Zune, I hope this was insightful in some way. Otherwise, thank you for subscribing to this podcast or following it and telling your friends all about it, spreading the word about Creative Control. It means a lot. This is the 10th year of the show. It's still going somehow. So thank you. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.